And now the horses are going into the gate for the eighth race, the 38th running of the Hollywood Gold Cup. A handicap for three-year-olds and older at 1 mile and one quarter. On the main track, the first $350,000 guaranteed. 12 are going into the starting gate, and the Elmendorf Farm has an entry in here, Pay Tribute and Rajab. The others are Legendario, Terrace Bulba, Bel Marino, Caucasus, Mark's Place, Cascapedia, the Philly, Austin Mittler, Ancient Title, Crystal Water, and Festive Mood. Crystal Water carries top weight of 129 pounds, Ancient Title 125. They're all in the gate now, and the flag is up, and there they go. Rajab is going to the front. Pay Tribute is second. Legendario third. Crystal Water fourth. Austin Mittler is fifth. Festive Mood sixth on the outside. Then Mark's Place and Terrace Bulba coming by the stands. It's Austin Mittler in front by a neck. Crystal Water is second by a head. Festive Mood third on the outside by a length. Rajab fourth by a length. Pay Tribute is fifth. Mark's Place sixth. Ancient Title sixth on the extreme outside. Then Terrace Bulba, Legendario, Cascapedia, Bel Marino, and Caucasus Trails. Turning into the backstretch, it's Austin Mittler in front by a head. Crystal Water is second by a length. Mark's Place third by a neck. Festive Mood fourth by a head. There goes Ancient Title moving up on the outside. Now down the backstretch, it's Crystal Water in front by a neck. Mark's Place is second by a neck. Ancient Title third on the outside by half length. Austin Mittler fourth. Pay Tribute is fifth. Cascapedia sixth on the extreme outside. Then Festive Mood, Rajab, Terrace Bulba, Caucasus, Legendario, and Bel Marino. Around the far turn, it's Crystal Water in front by a one length. Mark's Place is second by a length and a half. Cascapedia, the filly, is third, moving up strongly on the outside. Ancient Title fourth by five lengths. And Rajab turning into the stretch. It's Crystal Water in front by one length. Cascapedia is second by a head. Mark's Place third by a one length. Ancient Title fourth on the inside. And Caucasus, now it's Crystal Water on the inside by a neck. Cascapedia is second. Here comes Caucasus on the outside. Crystal Water and Cascapedia, they're head and head. Cascapedia and Crystal Water. Crystal Water, here comes Caucasus. And Crystal Water's the winner by a neck. Cascapedia second with Caucasus finishing third. What a finish that was between Crystal Water, Cascapedia, and the fast-closing Caucasus. Crystal Water having good speed right from the start, and then when challenged by Cascapedia in the stretch run, proved best in the final strides by about a neck. Crystal Water carrying top weight of 129 pounds. And Crystal Water paid $6.80 to win, $4 even to place, $2.60 to show. Cascapedia, the filly, running second, $5.360, and Caucasus, $4.60 to show. Ancient Title finished fourth. Crystal Water is owned by Mrs. Connie M. Ring, was bred by Mrs. Connie M. Ring here in California. Roger Clapp, the trainer, and the rider was Lafitte Pinkai Jr. On the quarter was 2 minutes flat.
With a little more than 3/8 of a mile to go, Convenience is now drawing out to a length lead. Now it's a length and a half. Convenience drawing out to a length and a half lead, but Typecast is hanging on gamely and coming on again on the outside. The three quarters was run in 1:10 flat. Passing the quarter pole, Convenience still has the lead by about 3/4 of a length. Now it's a length. Now it's a length and a half. Convenience is drawing out. Convenience by 2 lengths, with Typecast still coming on. They ran the mile in 1:35 flat. Convenience still in front, but Typecast is closing the gap on the inside. Convenience, and here comes Typecast on the rail. Now they're head and head, nose and nose. And Convenience is the winner by a nose, with Typecast finishing second, racing on the inside. What a horse race.
You're ready to talk horses, because it's time for Inside Horse Racing. Daily Racing Form columnist Barry Irwin will be here for the next full hour to answer your questions about the sport of kings. Inside Horse Racing, the program designed to take you behind the scenes of Southern California's racetracks.
You just heard the stretch call of the 1972 match race between Convenience and Typecast.
and the caller of that race was Harry Henson, who since 1959 has been the premier race caller in California while working at Hollywood Park in Del Mar. Harry will be here for the next full hour answering questions sent in by listeners and compiled by me and my staff. Harry, welcome to Inside Horse Racing.
It's nice to be here, Barry.
Harry, you started your racing career in the late 1930s. Could you give us a little background on how you first fell into this position?
Well, this is quite a story, really, Barry. It was after I'd quit riding, and I was hired as a steward at the little fair meeting at Western Washington Fair just south of Seattle. And part of my duties was to be a placing judge, too. So I went over to the stand on opening day of this particular meeting to place the horses, 1, 2, 3, as they went across the finish line, and to act as a steward, and the fair management had a fellow by the name of Graham McNamee there to be the master of ceremonies. This particular meeting was not just horse racing. They had rodeo acts, high wire acts, just a big fair. And we were part of the so-called show, the horse racing. And when the horses came on the track for the first race in between the rodeo act and the high wire act, the manager told Graham McNamee to get up there and call the race. And Graham turned to me. I'd been introduced to him. He says, "No way." He said, "I called a race at New York once." I believe he said at Aqueduct, but I'm not sure. Uh-huh. And he said, "I just botched it up real good, and I vowed I'd never call another one." Well, there didn't seem to be anybody else around, so they grabbed me, shoved me up against the mic, and said, "Harry, you know the horses, go ahead." And I did, and I called the races there for about 25 years after that.
How old were you at that time, Harry?
In my real early 20s.
Early 20s. Okay. Harry, you told us that you started off in this sport as a rider. Did you ride against any particularly good jockeys?
I rode against all of the best on the West Coast, believe me. Eddie R. Carroll broke in the same year I did. We had the apprentice allowance, the so-called bug, at the same time. Uh-huh. A lot of bug riders, Charlie King, Willie Mulder was riding there then, the great trainer after that, and Georgie Wolfe, Bobby Jones. I could go on and on and on. Sylvia Cucci. There was all kinds of riders. They came out from the East and they rode at Caliente, and that's actually where I did most of my riding.
Uh-huh. Have you maintained any friendships with some of these jockeys to the present day?
Oh, yes. I know Eddie real well. Charlie King, who is a paddock judge here for so many years and is now for the harness, is a good buddy of mine. And, Ralph West, who's a trainer. I could name lots of them.
As far as Eddie Arcaro goes, he's been coming to Del Mar for the past couple of years for the Rocking Chair Derby. Do you get together and share old memories?
I have to, yes, but I have to put something in here. I left out one of the most important. I rode against Johnny Longdon, too, and Johnny is a good friend of mine. He was a good rider, even in those days. And now, that question, Barry?
Eddie Arcaro, when he comes down to Del Mar for the Rocking Chair Derby, do you get together and share old memories?
We have talked and talked about old times. In fact, times were a little tough in those days. This is the early 30s, as you know, and we rode in a car together from Caliente one time up to Tanforan, up on in the Bay Area, and that's where Eddie really got his big break. He got in with a man, can't think of his name right at the moment, and he went back east, and then he started really doing well. Previous to that, he was just another bug boy starting out.
Uh-huh. Now, Old Banana Nose, as he used to be called and is sometimes still referred to, served as one of the co-hosts for the Triple Crown races this year, the first two anyway, and he made some statements that some people considered pretty outrageous about Seattle Slough. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that, Harry.
Well, unfortunately for me, I didn't get much chance to hear that. I was a little busy in the booth at Hollywood Park. Of course, we were racing at the time of all three of those races. And I didn't get, but I have read about it. I think, I don't believe that he and Howard Cosell should have said the things they did, because they were kind of preempting the horse. Anyway, he went on to prove that they were wrong.
He did. I'll tell you one thing about Eddie. He did kind of put his foot in it a little bit, but I think a lot of the things that have been said about him, they've been quoting him out of context, because I've interviewed him a few times, and he does come up with some pretty outrageous things, but when you place them into context and the whole sphere of it, he says some pretty wise things. I think it's really unfortunate that as big a star as Eddie was as a rider, that he hasn't been able to find his niche somewhere in the thoroughbred industry.
Well, I agree with that, but I'm sure he hasn't quit trying yet.
Yeah, sure. Harry, you've seen some pretty good horses in your time. And I know that one of the best ones was early in your career at Kalliani, and this was the New Zealand sensation Farlap. What do you remember about him?
Well, I can remember this much. Myself and almost everyone that witnessed that race that day at Agua Kalliani have maintained through the years that Farlap was probably the greatest horse they ever saw. And I believe he was the greatest horse I ever saw. And the reason for that was that I rode about 8 races that day. I didn't ride in the handicap, the race that he was in. Johnny Longden did, I remember. He rode a horse called Behemoth. But anyway, the rider that came up with him, a boy by the name of Billy Elliott, came up from Australia with Farlap, although Farlap was bred in New Zealand. He did a lot of his racing in Australia, too. And he told me in the jocks room, we had the same valet that day, and he told me just exactly what he was going to do with the horse. He said, I'm just going to lope him out of the gate. It was 1.25 miles, so they had that long run to the first turn. And he said, I'm just going to come out of the gate and let them go on about their business, and I'll just gallop out of the gate, and then when I get to the turn, I'll take him out real wide around the first turn, and then I'll let him run. And then when I get to the front, I'll pull him up. And that's exactly what he did. He was so far out of it, he looked like the pony boy galloping along behind the field when they came up the stretch the first time. Uh-huh. He took him to the middle of the track around the turn, and he let that big horse run, and he ran by those horses, and by the time they hit the 5-8 pole, he's 4 in front. Then he took him up from there to the wire. That's how great he was.
Yeah. What happened to Farlap after that, Harry?
They shipped him up to in the Bay Area. I've forgotten the name of the town right at the moment. And they had him on a farm or a ranch, whatever you want to call it. And he got a bad, bad case of colic, and it killed him.
Yeah. In fact, there were some people that thought that the grass might have been sprayed with some sort of poison and that this led to his demise. And there were still other people in Australia and New Zealand that loved the horse so much that they thought that because he had won that race at Kalliani, that some bad people actually tried to poison him to death. Harry, you've also had some pretty interesting calls, such as calling races on foggy days and stuff like this. Is there any one of those particular foggy day episodes that you recall that was pretty interesting?
Every one of them are interesting, Barry, because you can't see anything. I've been able to... I can think of one in particular in the fog. I've called a lot of races where it was really foggy. I worked at Portland Meadows for quite a few years, and we used to get quite a lot of fog there. But when I was in Chicago at Washington Park one day, a good horse was running in a handicap. And at that time, I was calling the feature race every Saturday nationwide on the monitor show, what they called the monitor show. I believe it was NBC.
On radio.
On radio, yes. And when it came time for the race, the fog had rolled in so thick you couldn't even see the tote board from the announcer's booth. You couldn't see the tote board in front of the grandstand, and this race happened to be 6 furlongs, which made it very difficult because you had no way of knowing when they were at the gate and no way of knowing when they broke, because we did not have an electric timer that you could watch the board and know whether as they were going by the certain poles to get the fractions. Uh-huh. Nothing whatsoever. So I checked my watch. I knew what the post time was, and I told the public at the track, plus I was on this radio show up live at the same time, strictly live, that the horses were about at the gate. There's a good horse in there by the name of Swoon Son.
Oh, right.
And Swoon Son was in his prime then, and he was the heavy favorite, so I went through Swoon Son's history and kept talking and talking all the time. Then I happened to hear the bell of the starting gate. It was so quiet, and with a heavy air, you could hear the bell. So I said, there they go, I think, and kept talking about Swoon Son. When they came out of the fog near the finish line, here he was, 5 in front. So it worked out perfectly.
That's funny. About the same time Swoon Son was earning just about $1 million in the Midwest, there was another horse in California named Swaps, and also one in the East called Nashua. And they met in 1955 in one of the most talked about and publicized match races in the history of horse racing. Harry, you were the caller for that race, weren't you?
Yes, I did. I called the race at the track. It was at Washington Park in Chicago in the fall of 1955, just before Labor Day. And it was quite a horse race, really.
Now, there was a lot of talk after the race that the hoof that had been plaguing Swaps throughout the latter part of his career had flared up just before the race. And when it was over, Rex Ellsworth and Mish Tenney used this as kind of an excuse to explain why Nashua handled Swap so easily. Was there much talk about this before the race itself, as you recall?
No, Barry, I really didn't hear anything much about, and I don't believe anyone else did either before the horse race. You see, the management had sold seats. They had about 30-some thousand seats put in out in the front. Everything was sold out. It was on a Wednesday. The track was loaded to the hilt. Publicity was great. Nashua had just got through winning the Arlington Classic, among other races that he had won, and I called that one, too, at Arlington Park. And Swaps, of course, had won the Kentucky Derby, beaten Nashua. It was a natural. And when they got... It had rained. The track was off. It was a drying-out track, a slow track. And when they brought Nashua over there, I don't think I've ever seen a horse that looked so ready as he was for that race. And Eddie Arcaro rode him, as you know, and Eddie had told me previously that he was going to be very, very tough to beat, even for a great horse like Swaps. And when they came out of the gate, it appeared to me that Swaps was not quite ready for the break. Now, whether he was or not, and he broke out, Eddie opened up with Nashua, and when Swaps got to him, got lapped on him a time or two around the turn, Eddie had the best path on the racetrack, and Swaps and Bill Shoemaker were forced to race on the outside of him. And when Eddie let that big horse run around the turn, Swaps just didn't have it with him, and he opened up on him, and he won by about six lengths.
Yeah. I think Shoemaker since then has said that Eddie taught him a pretty good riding lesson or two in that particular race. Harry, you've also seen some of the other really good horses to race in North America since the 1950s, and one of them was Dr. Fager. What do you remember about him?
Well, Dr. Fager has been, ever since he came to Hollywood Park, I believe it was 1968, and what was it, the Californian that he won, or the Gold Cup? The Californian, I believe it was. And I remember that he carried high weight of 130 pounds. He came with a big reputation, or he would not have had to carry that much weight. And he really proved that his reputation was not exaggerated at all. He was a very, very impressive horse, and I've had the good fortune of seeing almost all of the good horses that ever raced in the Midwest or the West Coast over these years, and I have to say that Dr. Fager would be my second choice to Farlap as the best horses I've ever seen.
Okay, Harry, that was a 1968 Californian, and Johnny Nayrud brought him out initially because he figured he was going to get in the race with 124 pounds. It was a stakes based on money won. And 2 days before the race, after he was out here, you know, with the horse on the grounds, he realized that it was really 130 pounds. And they were not about to go back, and they ran him in that race. And here's Harry Henson's entire recall of that 1968 Californian stakes.
And there they go. Dr. Roy E. is going to the front. Kissin' George is second, moving up on the inside. Dr. Fager, third on the outside. Rising Market is fourth. Barb's Delight, fifth. Fieldmaster, sixth. Then Sand Devil, Our Michael, Traffic Charger, Proud Land on the inside. Zulu Lad, Aurelius, and Lucky Bush around the turn. It's Kissin' George in front, drawing out to by two lengths. Rising Market is second, by a head. Dr. Roy E. third, by a length and a half. Dr. Fager fourth, by a length and a half. Barb's Delight is fifth. Fieldmaster sixth. Sand Devil, Our Michael, Gamely, and Proud Land going into the fire turn. There goes Dr. Fager moving up on the inside. It's still Kissin' George in front on the outside by a neck. Dr. Fager is second on the rail by a length and a half. Rising Market third by a neck. Dr. Roy E. fourth by four lengths. Barb's Delight is fifth. Gamely sixth. Our Michael and Fieldmaster around the turn. It's Dr. Fager in front on the rail by a head. Kissin' George is second by two and a half lengths. Rising Market third by a length. Dr. Roy E. is fourth. Barb's Delight fifth, and Gamely turning into the stretch. It's Dr. Fager in front by three quarters of a length. Kissin' George is second by one length. Barb's Delight third. Gamely is fourth. And Rising Market Aurelius pulled up. It's Dr. Fager in front by two and a half lengths. Gainley is second. Rising Market third. And Barb's Delight. Dr. Fager in front. Gamely and Rising Market. And Dr. Fager is the winner by three lengths. Gamely second by a length with Rising Market finishing third.
That was a 19 with Dr. Fager winning under 130 pounds, mile and a 16th, 140 and four fifths. That certainly was an exciting race, wasn't it, Harry?
Yes, it was, and very impressive was the mare that ran second, Gamely. She was really something.
She was one of my particular favorites, too. Harry, why don't you give us what your yearly schedule is as far as where you travel and which racetracks you work at?
Well, at the present time, I'm here, of course, at Hollywood Park now. Go to Del Mar from here and work the Del Mar meeting. And in recent years, I have been going to the Albuquerque Fair, but I don't do that anymore because they had an extension of dates and it conflicted too much with Del Mar. But I have been going to Sunland Park, which is located just outside of El Paso, Texas, and working during the winter and then coming back here for the Hollywood Park meeting in the spring. But I'm not too sure what I'm going to do this winter.
How many days off during the year do you usually have?
Well, about 3 weeks at the most. That is in between the Del Mar meeting and the opening of Sunland Park. That is what it has been for the past 15 years anyway.
Uh-huh. And obviously you don't have time for any really extensive vacations. How do you spend your recreational time when you're not at the track?
I like to play golf. I play quite a bit of golf. I'm not a good golfer by any means. In fact, very poor. I should be a lot better than I am for all the practice I've had. But and I used to bowl a lot, but haven't been able to bowl in the last 6 or 7 years since I had an eye operation. I was stopped from bowling or lifting anything heavy. And they consider a 16-pound bowling ball and throwing it down the alley as a strain, so I can't do that anymore. But I do play a lot of golf.
Okay. When you had the eye operation, I think it was on your retina, wasn't it?
Yes, I had a torn and detached retina in my right eye, and they had to piece it back together again. And I can see out of it. It's not quite as good as it was before, but it doesn't bother me with calling the races.
Okay. How did that incident occur? Was it an accident of some sort?
No, that's what the doctors... I did go to one of the specialists, the best eye doctors in the world at Houston, Texas, flew to Houston. And he and his partner are the ones that did the operation, and it was about a 3-hour operation because they had to piece that retina back together again besides... I had to go back 2 or 3 times for treatments afterwards, but I don't know what actually caused it. I was calling the races... Well, I was having an eye examination in a place in El Paso when it really popped. All I could see was blood in my right eye. And then it cleared up. I was calling the races one night at Sunland Park on a Friday night. They raced at nights on Friday only, and it did it again. So I got a hold of a doctor real quick, and they shot me over to Houston.
How long were you laid up for? I mean, how long was it before you were able to call races again?
Well, not too long. I was doing the NBC show at that time at Santa Anita every Saturday, flying over here to Los Angeles and calling the feature race on Saturday. The NBC happened to have it that particular year. CBS had had it previous to that. I worked for many years with Gil Stratton, as you probably know, and the CBS crew during the Saturday features at both Santa Anita and Hollywood Park and Del Mar. But this happened to be an NBC year. I was in the hospital 9 days. I got out on a Thursday, and of course I had patches and stuff all over my eye, but I did fly out here and call that Saturday feature, which I probably shouldn't have done, but the doctor told me I could as long as he only called one race. Uh-huh. And then I called all the rest of them then on. But I didn't go back actively calling all races at Sunland Park for about 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. Now, there are many people out in the listening audience who fancy themselves as someday maybe being able to make a race announcer or race caller of themselves. Harry, why don't you give us a little background on how you developed your particular style and if there were any people that you particularly admired and not exactly copied but tried to pick up helpful hints from?
Well, about the only one that I had really actively heard previous to the time that I was shoved up against that microphone that year was Joe Hernandez, for one, and Joe was a good friend of mine. In fact, for a short while, he was my agent when I was riding.
I'm
talking about, yes, Joe Hernandez, just for a short while before I went up to Canada. And then there was a fella in Seattle that called the races, Chick O'Neill, and he was more or less had the same style as Joe. I think if you heard Joe Hernandez and you heard Harry Henson, you'd have to say that they were a lot alike, not entirely, but called similarly. We both used the There They Go, where a lot of other callers say they're off or they're off and running or whatever. And I really didn't pick up any particular style. I was calling those races at the fair and trying to make them interesting and exciting for the public because there was no wagering on them. So you had to get the crowd roaring, and that's the way I did it.
Uh-huh.
Now, of all the race announcers that I've heard, and I know several other people have commented on this too, you come as close to making a race appear as accurate as a chart. A lot of people will jazz it up with a lot of words and exclamations and stuff like that, but your call is very precise and your margins are really good. Do you concentrate on this more or less, or is this just developed as the years have gone?
No, I believe it's just developed. My feeling originally in calling races at big tracks or mile tracks or whatever, even smaller tracks, half-mile tracks, were that everyone in the grandstand has got a ticket on some horse in every race. And I think that their horse deserves a call, or at least let them know where they are at two or three stages during the race if you possibly can. That's why I like to go all the way back on the field in the run down the back stretch and point out where each horse is. And as you know, I call all the races on radio here from Hollywood Park, too, so your margins of, even though the public at the track might see how far one horse is in back of another, the people listening on the air would like to know just how far, what the difference is between the horses, so I try to bring it all together and call the races it actually is at the time.
Okay. Now, in other parts of the country, as well as in California, a lot of announcers will stop calling them before they get to the 16th pole. Now, several times you'll bring these horses right up to the wire. Now, I know you once told me that you had a problem with this in Chicago where they weren't used to it when you first started working there. What's your feeling on bringing the horses up to the wire as far as announcing them?
Well, I think it's ridiculous to drop the call at the 16th pole, some of them even as far back as the 8th pole, because you're losing the height of interest in the race is the finish, or nearing the finish. And so many times, especially on the grass course here, for instance, you'll have four different horses cross the finish line ahead of the four that were in front at the 16th pole. In other words, the horses coming from behind are converging on the leaders, and the leaders are backing up. And so if I dropped the call at the 16th pole, the numbers when they went up on the totalizator board would be altogether different than the last call that I made at the 16th pole. The race is not over at the 16th pole, so why quit there?
Right.
And as you mentioned, when I did go to Chicago, the stewards jumped me right away. I called them right down to the finish line, 1, 2, 3, and just before the finish line. I try to drop the call just before the finish line and make my last call how I think the numbers are going up on the board, even if it's close or not, to call right. them that way. And I did that in Chicago, and the stewards, as I said, they called me right, oh, you can't do that. You've got to drop them at the 16th pole. In fact, they wanted me to go a little further back than that. And I said that I didn't want to do it because, for what I've already said, the numbers would be altogether different in a majority of races
right.
than they would be at the 16th pole. That is not the finish of the race. So through the management and the stewards there, they said, well, okay, but the first time you make a mistake and call a wrong horse, why, you're going to make you drop him at the 16th pole. Well, fortunately for me, they never did make me drop him. I've been doing it ever since.
Okay. Now, most people realize that the reason that Harry doesn't actually call them at the finish line is because there is a chance that he might make a mistake and somebody might throw a ticket away. However, he does call the finish line for radio and TV. When it's, well, radio in particular. Now, Harry, what method do you use to cut off the sound? How do you go through this?
Well, we have our recorders going, of course, all during the running of the race, and when the horses get down near the finish and I make my last call for the public, I automatically kick off the switch here that disconnects my mic from the sound at the track. In other words, I quit calling out over the public address system at the track because I've cut off the microphone switch. But I do continue the call for TV and for the tape. And I notice now this year for the first time they're using my finish call on the reruns here, which as long as I'm right, I guess it's all right. I hope I don't make too many mistakes.
Okay. Now this interview is being conducted atop the grandstand roof at Hollywood Park in the private announcing booth of Harry Henson. And we're looking at some of his equipment, and a lot of it is sophisticated. One of our listeners from Orange County sent in a question, and they wanted to know how Harry actually transmits his race calls to KIEV for the broadcast later, which emanates at which begins at 6 o'clock and goes to 6:30 all racing evenings.
Well, I'm not a technician, Barry. I have an engineer up here with me every day that turns on and off the machines and tightens up the dead air parts on the tape. In other words, when I say the horses, when I lead into a race, and I give the rundown on the field, what race it is, and then I say they're all in the gate now, the flag is up. Of course, he stops the machine because the horses aren't even on the track yet. But when I say the flag is up, actually, when the horses are in the gate and the flag is up, they start the machine again. And during that delay of time between the time that the flag is up and they're still in the gate, the starter's looking them over, and, you know, sometimes there's quite a delay. So that means dead on the tape. Well, they tighten that up so that we get the call right away and tighten up the whole tape that way. We have a direct line to the station from here. And when we are on the air on this station at 6 o'clock every race day, why, it's coming right from here. We send it right from the booth at Hollywood Park.
Okay, now sometimes people will tune in at 6 and your show is not yet on. It might be 5 minutes late or it might be 10 minutes late. Is this because the last race is going late or the feature is going late?
It's because the last race is going late. We always get the feature on, but there are times that the post time for the last, you see, this is a half-hour show that I have every night, as you know, and we have to be off the air at 6:29. Now, if the last race is run at 6:25, there's no way we're going to get it on that tape and have the official and the prices and everything else at that time. So occasionally we'll have to have it set back 5 minutes or even 10 minutes for the simple reason that we can't get the last race on, and I believe more people listen to the last race than they do the first. Because a lot of people I know leave Hollywood Park after the feature race, maybe buy their Exacta tickets or whatever they want to do in that respect, turn on their radios in the car, and they listen. They want to know who won the last race. That is the reason we do that.
Right. Okay. Harry, why don't you send us through a typical working day of yours? What time you get up? What time you come to the track? What time you go home? Stuff like that.
Well, you mean here at Hollywood Park. Over at Sunland for many years, I was a racing secretary, too, so I had to get up early there, you know, something like 6 o'clock in the morning. And I've done that for many years, been a racing official at different tracks, in addition to being the caller. But here, of course, and at Del Mar now, for a while I was the placing judge at Del Mar, and I got up early then, too. But I don't have to do it here. I come out to the track usually about 11 o'clock, unless there's something special that has to be done earlier than that. And get my stuff together, my programs, play a game of crib maybe to relax with some of the boys in the press box, but then eat lunch. And then I'm always in the booth before 1 o'clock. And at 1 o'clock, which is an hour before post time, at 1 o'clock I received, or shortly after 1, I received the overweights and changes from the jockey's room and prepare that and prepare my lead-in for the radio show. And by that time, it's time to go out over the public address system, welcome the public. Well, I don't stay up too late anymore. And, when I go home from here, I eat my dinner and watch some television and go to bed whenever the mood hits me and get up accordingly.
Okay. Now we're going to take a station break. Harry, obviously there's more to being a race caller than just being an announcer. There's a certain sensitivity to what goes on all over the racetrack, and that means the front side and the back side. Now, I know that you've helped both of your sons, Rick and Gary, to become announcers and get into the business. Can you give us a little idea of what kind of a background you wanted them to have?
Well, my oldest son, Rick, is now the racing secretary at the racetrack in Denver, Centennial Park in Littleton, Colorado, near Denver. And he also has been a race caller, but he has done numerous things. He's been a jockey's agent, and he ran the film patrol for many years in the New Mexico racetrack, so he has a pretty good background in racing. But my youngest boy, Gary, who is now the caller at Long Acres Racetrack in Yakima, in Washington, up in Washington, in my hometown of Seattle, did not have any background in racing. He had not worked at any other job. And so he came down here, and I helped him a little bit, had him call a few races and taped a few and criticized him a little bit, which a father always will do to a son. Uh-huh. And anyway, shortly after that, the job opened up at Long Acres, and he's been there now for the last 4 or 5 years. I'm not 4 years, I believe. Uh-huh. And he's doing well.
What are the advantages to knowing what's going on at the racetrack when you are a race caller?
Well, that is one thing, as I was going to mention about my youngest son, with no racing background, I requested the general manager of the Long Acres racetrack to give him a job in the racing office in the morning. and let him learn what happens on the backstretch when they're taking entry. Let him learn a little bit about being a jockey's agent. Let him learn a little bit about how races are compiled. And that way, when he's on the microphone talking to the public, whether it be over the public address system or on radio or TV, whatever, he would have a background knowledge and know what he was talking about. Whereas you bring a newcomer in here, regardless of how good an announcer he may be or how good a caller he may be, he probably wouldn't know exactly what to do if there was a late scratch during the running of a race. Refunds, free mutual tickets in case of a scratch. And a lot of things that happen in addition to actually calling the horse race. For instance, Barry, an announcer's job just doesn't quit with just calling the race. You give changes, overweights over the public address system. You introduce people into the winner's circle, sometimes big celebrities. You give time warnings. The horses are nearing the gate, a 5-minute warning, a 3-minute warning, which I do, and they're at the gate. There are numerous things. One of the most important is in case of an inquiry, where we rerun the videotape after the stewards make their decision on whether or not there will be a disqualification. It's up to the announcer to tell the public and show the public at the same time on the videotape machines, closed-circuit TV, exactly what happened and why the stewards made the decision that they did. That is a very important job.
Right. So you're not only representing yourself, you're representing the stewards and the racetrack, and without a good foundation or background, you really have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, that's the way I feel about it. I shouldn't really say too much about that, because I've done practically everything there is to do in thoroughbred racing, starting with learning to ride, and I worked in the mutuals. I was a jockey's agent. I've been a racing official. I've been a caller and what have you. But you do have to have a general knowledge of everything that goes on at a racetrack during a racing day.
Now, Harry, getting back to style, I notice that one thing you do is you try to make sure that the public has a pretty good idea of who not only wins the race, but who you think is going to finish second and third. And one thing you seem to have a real good knack for is picking up a horse that's got a lot of momentum on the outside. He may be fourth or fifth with 20 or 30 yards to go, but 9 out of 10 times, if you call him third, he's going to wind up third. Is this something that you just pick up through depth perception?
Well, I think you might call it that, Barry, because you get to know these horses pretty good, and I do read the racing form, by the way, and if I don't know a field of horses, if they come in from the east or some other place, find out whether they go to the front, whether they show early speed, or whether they have a tendency to come from behind in their better races. So if I see a horse coming from behind, like, for instance, a Silky Sullivan making a move, I'm going to give him that call, because if he maintains that momentum, he'll be right there at the finish. If not winning it, he'll be right close. But a lot of times they'll fool you. They'll make that run, and they get about the 16th pole, and they've had it, and kind of flatten out and hang from there on in. So you're not always too accurate that way.
Okay. Now, I asked you earlier if there were different reactions from different fans throughout the country, and you said no, that most race fans were race fans. However, I think when you first started off in Chicago, you introduced a few terms there, or a few different mannerisms of style that hadn't been used before. What kind of problems do you run into with something like this?
Well, speaking about the Chicago episode, by the way, I worked Chicago for 4 years. I worked the Washington Park meeting, the Balmoral meeting, and the Arlington Park meeting for 4 summers, 1955 through 1958. And then I resigned because I didn't want to be away from my family. My boys were just teenagers at the time, and I lived in Seattle, had a home in Seattle, my wife Helen and I. And I just had enough of being away from early May until after Labor Day and missing all the fun with my children. And I missed Seattle, I missed Long Acres, I missed, more than anything, I missed my wife. I was there all by myself. So anyway, I resigned after the 58 meeting, and then this job here at Hollywood Park opened up the following spring when Hal Morgott became ill, and I was called by Mr. Jim Stewart at that time, also through Joe Gottstein, and who was the manager at Long Acres. And they offered me the job here on the telephone, and I said, okay, I'll be there. So I've been here ever since.
Now, Chick Anderson just went from California back to the east, and he's working at Belmont Park, and there's been quite a reaction so far to Chick's style of calling a race, some of the words he uses. Did you run into this same kind of a problem in Chicago?
Well, I started to say that, Barry. About the only thing that I can recall at the present time, Mr. Ben Lindheimer, Marge Everett's father, was the big man at these tracks that I worked, Washington Park and Arlington. He was the vice president or president and everything. And he's the one that I went, when I was hired to go out there, he's the one that I talked to first in his office. And he told me to go ahead and do what I wanted. If I didn't do what they wanted, he would let me know. Well, the first day, I called the races there, and I went with There They Go, right out of the starting gate. I got a call from the stewards saying that they didn't particularly like There They Go because the town had been... No, it wasn't the stewards. I'm wrong there. That's another story. It was somebody in management, I don't know who, sent me a memo the following day in the morning and told me that not to say There They Go, to say They're Off. So I tried it when they got in the gate the first race. I tried to say They're Off. I didn't know what else to do right at the moment. As long as it was their racetrack, I was going to give it a try anyway. If I didn't like it, I could always go back home. And I said, then There They Off. I just couldn't get it out. I've called thousands and thousands of races saying, there they go. The minute that gate opens and I see the horses come out, I got a call right away from Mr. Lindheimer at the track, and he said, what's going on? And I told him the story, and he said, you, Harry, you do it your way. And he said, and I did it my way from then on. And they got to see, the public seemed to like it. At least I had a lot of comment on it and a lot of letters.
Uh-huh. Now, you have two kinds of laughs when you're calling a race. One kind of a laugh is you'll come up to a horse's name that's kind of funny, like, my name is Sue. I remember the first time you read that horse's name, you got a chuckle out of it. And then every once in a while, like everybody else, you're not infallible, and you'll make a mistake or call a wrong horse, and then you'll kind of give a little chuckle there. What are some of the funnier names of horses you've seen, or names that maybe you couldn't even pronounce two times in a row in a race, because there are some really weird names in racing?
Well, let me answer the first one first. One of the biggest responses, if you can call it that, that I had from the public here at Hollywood Park was a few years back when there was a horse called Wu Lung Wong in the race. And I had never heard the name before. There was also another horse in there, first time starter, that had a very peculiar name. And as the horses went down the backstretch in a full field of horses, I called the horse that had the other peculiar name, and then right in back of him is this Wu Lung Wong, and I couldn't think of his name, so help me. I said, Wu Lung Fung, or whatever it is, and the public just roared. I've got that tape, and it's really comical.
Yeah.
But other names that come to mind, I had a horse in Chicago, a horse that was shipped over from England, and the boys in the press box, when this horse started working, said, well, Harry, wait till this horse starts. You're going to have a lot of fun with him.
Uh-huh.
And the name of the horse was Messum Bryanthemum, all one word, Messum Bryanthemum. And do you think that isn't a tongue twister? And the first time the horse started was on the grass going a mile and an eighth in a six-horse field, so I had to call him numerous times during the running of the race, and I let it come out, but it was a tough one. I got him down. Then there's another horse called Existentialist, which was a little bit of a tongue twister. And then we have so many Spanish names and French-named horses and that are in French, and it's a little... Certainly not sure of a lot of the pronunciations, but I do my best to call them right.
Uh-huh. Do you check with other people sometimes, sir?
Oh, yes. If not so much around here. When I worked Sunland Park, there was numerous Mexican or Spanish names of people that I had to introduce in the Winner's Circle, for instance, and I don't like to mispronounce a person's name. Mispronounce a horse's name, the horse doesn't care, but
yeah.
People do. And... I try to check whenever I can, but then the people in the press box were who I usually check with. If I don't have an opportunity to contact the owner or trainer, even the trainers don't know a lot of times. The horse is bred and named by another individual, and they a lot of times do not know the correct pronunciation of the horse's name. But if I can, I do check.
Yeah. I remember a couple of years ago there was a horse called Greg Less that was bred by one guy named Greg and another named Less. And throughout his career, everybody just thought his name was Greggles. Nobody had any idea that it was Greg Less. Harry, could you give us kind of an idea of how you memorize a field before a race, whether you go by names or the colors of the silks, how you actually go about memorizing the field?
Well, I usually start when the horses are in the paddock here at Hollywood Park, if I can see them. It's a little difficult from my booth to see the horses in the paddock, but most tracks you don't see the paddock, like at Santa Anita, for instance, or Del Mar. When the horses come on the track, I start memorizing number one, number two, number three, and so forth. Not so much from the number, but the color of the silks that the jockey's wearing is the predominant thing that I use. And then I also make a mental note, or even a written note at times, on the blinkers that the horse is wearing and the color of those blinkers. Because when they're in the post parade, when I pick them out on the back stretch, if it's a little hazy or something, every little thing that you can pick out will help me to know when I see that horse during the running of the race that his name is so-and-so and the other one is something else. So it's predominantly the silks that the jockey is wearing, but not necessarily entirely. I sometimes check on the white feet if two colors, you know, if the jock silks are very similar, which there was two or three of them yesterday. Mm-hmm. And of course, the color of the horse.
Yeah. How about riding styles? Can you pick jockeys out down in the back stretch, say?
Well, I can, because I've watched these riders. I've been here 19 years, and I can tell Shoemaker. I used to be able to tell Longdon, Arquero, and a lot of others on their riding styles. Johnny Adams, you couldn't miss him. But all in all, there isn't too much difference in the riders today. They seem to ride about the same way. By that, I mean seat a horse the same way, whip the same way, and hand ride the same way. There are some that you can pick out right away. I can pick them out when they're galloping a horse on the backstretch. I can tell Shoemaker, I can tell Pink Eye, I can tell Sandy Holly, and a few others when they're just warming a horse up on the backside without even looking at the program. I can tell you some of them, but not all of them.
What if you were really hard-pressed, let's say you had another duty or an emergency to attend to, what's the quickest amount of time you think you could memorize a 12-horse field in if you were really pressed?
If I knew the horses, had called them and seen them recently in races, not necessarily, you know, within a month, we'll say. And if I knew the horses, it wouldn't take me too long. I could probably do it in 3 or 4 minutes, or maybe even less if I had to. But if it was a bunch of two-year-old maidens that I've never heard the names before and the colors and everything else were strange, I'd be in trouble.
Uh-huh. Okay. Now, Harry, since you've been calling races since 1938, obviously there's been a lot of people that have come to you and wanted to learn your trade. Have there been any of these that have gone on to any success, or have there been any kind of interesting stories in this regard?
Well, I can't say that I actually worked with the caller in Chicago, but all the time he was there, it's a young fellow that worked in the press box, and all the time I was there, he was practicing and making tapes and having my calls. And when I resigned there, he got the job, and that's been 19 years ago, and he's still calling the races in Chicago at practically all of the tracks. So I can't call him a protege, because all he did was kind of copy my style to a certain degree, but not entirely. Of course, my son Gary is doing well, and he has his own style. I told him, I said, you be an individual. Don't copy me. You do it whatever way you want. And he does call the races quite a bit differently than I do. But I've had two or three younger fellas over the years that have practiced with me and have gone on to be pretty good callers and had jobs. And a fellow that worked as my assistant up in the Fair Circuit in the Northwest called for many years at Portland Meadows until he became ill. And the racetracks in Montana, for instance. And, there have been others that have gone on. The fellow that's calling the races in Denver now came down to my booth at Sunland Park and practiced and talked to me. I can't take full credit for what he's doing, but let's say partially.
Uh-huh. Have there been any pretty funny stories with would-be callers that started off and maybe didn't quite make it?
Well, yes, there have been. A lot of them have made it, but there have been quite a few that haven't. I had a fella, for instance, I was calling the races in Las Vegas that year in 1954 when they had the quarter horse and turned out to be a mixed meeting. When the one of the local TV and radio announcers wanted to be a caller, and the general manager of the track asked me to let him call a few races, I did. The first time, it was a quarter horse race. They got in the gate. He said everything fine, gave the changes and everything else until they got in the gate. And then
when they broke, you could have heard a pin drop. There weren't very many people at the track anyway in Las Vegas at that time, and there still aren't. It isn't that kind of a town, but you could have heard a pin drop. He never said a word. I was acting as a placing judge in place of calling, and I ran up the stairs, and there he was, passed out cold in his chair. And he said, "I don't know what happened. I just couldn't think of a horse's name." We brought him around, and that was it. He walked out. He said, "Never again." I could tell you a story of something that I think is kind of cute in Spokane. At Playfair Racetrack in Spokane one year, now I was not involved in this, but I heard the story from many people. They needed a caller before the meeting opened, so they hired a man who said that he had done a lot of public address work, and he was a retired Army officer. And he knew horse racing, so he got up in the booth. The horses went to the gate for the first race, and he said, "Now they're at the gate, fine, everything went fine." And it was a 5/8 of a mile track, and the distance of the race was 6 furlongs, which means that they started 1/8 of a mile before the finish line in the stretch, so they had to go by the finish and then once around the track. Anyway, he says, "And they're off." And then dead silence. And about 12 seconds later, he says, "And there you have it." They had crossed the finish line. He thought the race was over and never mentioned a horse's name. I thought that was kind of comical.
That's really funny. Well, speaking of short races, even though that one was a little briefer than usual, you've also called quarter horse races. Is it as much fun to you, or is it a different kind of a challenge? What's the difference between the two?
Actually, Barry, there isn't any difference, except that they're over quicker, naturally, but I have called many thousands of quarter horse races, and I don't know how many thousand thoroughbred races, but I've been calling quarter horse races at Sunland Park, where they average about 25% of the races are quarter horse. And there is no difference. They come out with the silks, they get in the gate. The only part of it is that it's a little difficult to see who's in front when they break, because you're looking at them practically head-on coming out of the chutes, coming up the stretch, regardless of the distance. And, of course, 870-yard races are fairly easy because they have to run around a turn. You can pick them up. But coming up, I learned a little trick a few years back, and it's maybe a little hard for anyone to believe, but I could tell who's in front a little bit better by looking at their feet, as long as I know what the horse's name is. And if I look at their feet when they're coming up the lane, I can more or less tell a little better who's in front of the other horse. Uh-huh. And I've used that quite a bit in quarter horse racing.
Okay. Now, Harry, getting back to some of the better horses you've seen, you saw Native Diver. Was he one of your favorites?
He was one of everybody's favorites, Barry. The big black horse, yes. He was a game horse. He ran with his head high. You couldn't miss him. He was a very colorful horse, and a very great one, too.
He was a real crowd pleaser, and I know that you were working on television during that time. That must have really kind of spiced your day when you knew that the Diver was going to be in a race.
Well, yes, but, of course, Native Diver won a lot of races here at Hollywood Park that I called both on television and over the public address. But any time Native Diver was in the race, you could just hear the crowd when he came into the paddock before the race. You could hear them start to murmur, and then the rumble got bigger and bigger. And then when he went on the racetrack, he was just a crowd pleaser.
Uh-huh. How about another horse that was a crowd pleaser? One, he used to stop and look at the crowd itself, and that was Cougar II.
Well, Cougar was that way, too. Many a time, as you know, he'd get on the racetrack and he'd walk down. They never did take a pony with him, as I recall, a pony rider. Mm-hmm. He went by himself, and he'd go down the track, and no matter who was on him, whether it was Bill Shoemaker, who rode him most of the time, they'd just sit there and wait until he was ready to move on again. He'd look the crowd over, and that was it.
Uh-huh. Now, Harry, you've worked at several tracks throughout the country. Could you name just a few of them for us, just so we can get an idea of what parts of the country you've covered?
Well, I broke in, as I said, in the Northwest, and I called at numerous tracks up there, Long Acres in Seattle, my hometown, Portland Meadows in Portland, Oregon, as well as Gresham, Oregon, and some of the little fairs in the state, a number of them in which I was the general manager, along with being the caller. I called, as we've mentioned before, in Chicago for 4 years at Arlington Park and Washington Park, in which I saw many great horses run, many good horses run. I shouldn't say great. That's a word that we saved for the best. And I called the races, as I've mentioned, in Las Vegas for one meeting, and at Jefferson Downs in Louisiana, down in New Orleans for one meeting. And, well, of course, here at Hollywood Park, Del Mar.
Okay. Now, you've called some pretty big match races. There was a Chris Everett versus Miss Musket match race, the Swaps versus Nashua match race, and the Typecast versus Convenience. What are some of the particular problems involved in calling a race with only two horses in it?
Well, I found that out with the first big one that I ever called. I've called a lot of other match races, between match race between quarter horse and thoroughbreds. I've called match races between the Arabians and thoroughbreds. I've called mule races, and which would be kind of comical. One of the mule races at Sunland Park some years ago were 6 miles, and if you that wasn't a little tough to keep track, and I had to keep saying how many more laps they had to go around the track.
It was all around the track?
Yeah, 6 miles on a mile track. They went around 6 times. Only 2 finished out of 12. The rest of them all gave up. But it's a little difficult in a two-horse race, a match race, because what can you say? One horse is in front and the other is lapped on him, or one horse is in front by 4 or 5, like the Nashua Swaps match race, for instance, when they came into the stretch. You say, now it's Nashua by 4 and Swaps. Nashua by 4 and Swaps. Same with the Typecast Convenience race here, although they ran pretty well together, except when Typecast dropped back around the turn and Shoemaker took him back a little bit, if I recall right. I haven't discussed this, but if I remember the race, and then he came on again, which made it a very exciting race. But so many match races will be one-sided, like the War Admiral Seabiscuit match race, which, of course, I didn't call, but I have called, fortunately, I have called for me, I've called most of the big ones that have been run in recent years. And I'm glad I didn't call the one that Ruffian was in. But it's just a little difficult to make it interesting. In Chicago, for instance, I had a clocker come up in my booth and I gave the fractional times, because the fractional times at that time were not shown on the tote board. I thought that helped a little bit.
Yeah, that would add a little excitement to it. Harry, since you've been in the sport since the 30s, what would you say are some of the biggest changes overall in racing that you've noticed and you think have been helpful to the sport?
Well, you really threw one at me this time, Barry. Well, when I first broke into racing as an exercise boy and a rider, for instance, the starting gate was not the same. We broke from a webbing in the bell. There was no closed gates in those days. And when you went into the gate, sometimes there were just little stationary stalls that were just about 4 or 5 feet high, and that was all. And then they pulled a webbing down across in front of the horses, and they had assistant starters standing on the ground instead of up in the stall like they do today. And when the starter would let him go, he'd push his button, which would ring the bell, and that webbing would shoot up and away from him, like they do, for instance, in England and some of the European tracks. That starting gate, I think, is one of the greatest improvements in those days. Well, there's been a lot of others. The tracks are better today. The actual running surfaces are better today because they're better taken care of. During Depression days, they didn't have very much of a ground crew. I mean, a maintenance crew at the tracks, and you'd have a lot of rocks and holes, and they were really dangerous. I think that's something that should be mentioned. The tracks today are so much better.
We hear a lot today about how the tracks are too fast and there's no cushions and everything. Do you think there's anything to this?
Well, I don't think it makes any difference to the riders. I mean, except if a horse is too tuppy, of course, the horse cannot stride correctly. But no, I don't think there's too much to that, Barry. I think a lot of that, in some cases, I know, is strictly excuses.
Uh-huh. Okay, what other big changes have you seen that have really helped the sport, do you think?
Well, there are so many. The photo finish picture, for instance, has been a big asset. And in my early days, they didn't have any photo finish pictures. And I can recall one race that I rode up in Victoria, at a track in Victoria, where when I came galloping back after the race, I know that 6 horses went over the line ahead of me, but my number was up second, and the trainer was running out there flagging me down not to say a word, keep quiet, and sure enough, I weighed out, and they paid off on me second. I wasn't. But that's because the placing judges had just missed the call. You can't do that with a photo finish picture. And of course, the videotape or the film patrol. Originally, the film patrol and now the videotape has done a great deal to clean up the actual running of a race as far as the riders and horses are concerned, because they've got the living proof there, where in other days they could just say to a rider if he's riding rough or if they thought he was doing something he shouldn't do, which, believe me, happened many times, like hanging on to another horse, taking leg locking a rider and such as that. In these days, that's an impossibility because the evidence is right there.
Okay. Harry, when they run the rerun of a patrol film and you narrate it, is that language handed to you, or do they give you a couple of facts and you wing it from there? How does something like that transpire when you explain about an inquiry?
Well, the stewards, of course, look at the picture, and their booth is down below me here at Hollywood Park. And I also have a little monitor, so I can see what they're looking at, because they beam it up to me, too. But a lot of times I'm a little bit busy going out over the public address with changes on the next race and whatever's involved, so I don't see everything. One of the stewards comes up to my booth after they call me and say whether there is a disqualification or whether there's not a disqualification, whatever the case may be. Then I tell the public that we're going to show it again on the closed-circuit television monitors and try to point out the reason for the steward's decision. And they come up and just tell me just that. They say, Harry, this horse, well, usually steward Hubert Jones has been the one here at Hollywood Park this season, and sometimes it's one or two, one or more of the others. But they tell me why they disqualified the horse. This is what, and I have to point out to the public as they come head-on the horses involved as they're being shown on the screen so that they can see the actual infraction if there is one or if there is not actually an infraction of which the stewards think there should be a disqualification.
Okay. Harry, we've got about 2 minutes left. Just briefly in closing, where do you think racing's going? What do you see in the future of racing, and is there anything that you would particularly like to see?
Well, I'd particularly like to see it continue, Barry, which it will. There'll always be horse racing. Of course, around the country today, as most everybody knows, the attendance seems to be dwindling a little bit. It isn't quite as good as it was in the past recent years. But there'll always be horse racing, and as long as the game, and I call it a game, most people in the business call it a game, as long as it is supervised the way it is, and the crowds like it, and money is still around, there'll be horse racing.
Okay. Thank you very much, Harry. I'd like to thank Harry Henson for submitting to this rather long interview, and I hope everybody out there enjoyed it, because it is one of the few chances we have to spend with Harry, because he works at the track and is unable to come down to the Glendale studios of KIEV. We'll be returning next Friday at 6:30, and we'll be on for an hour from 6:30 to 7:30 to answer your questions about horse racing. Thank you, and good night.